You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with American poet and bookseller Danny Kane. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
My whole nonfiction book project started with a tweet thread I posted actually exactly 5 years ago on April 17th, 2019. It was just every bookseller has the ability to have this discussion, like the very discussion you're talking about. A customer comes in, it's like, oh, this book is, you know, 50% off on Amazon. Why should I buy it here? Every bookseller in the world needs to be prepared to have a discussion. You're probably going to have it on your first day at work. And in some ways, when this tweet thread 5 years ago went viral, I started to think about ways to create a resource for that discussion so people have some assets and some easy ways to talk about it. If not the model for talking about it, at the very least, some easy source material that they can use. And so eventually it became a zine first. And I self-published a zine that I was stapling and sending to bookstores for them to put on their front counters to sell for a couple bucks as a way to kind of help bridge that gap. Like, booksellers are really good at having this discussion among themselves, but I was interested, if I could, providing a resource that the discussion could happen across the front counter. The intent is that this is at least one person's way of talking about this in a way that doesn't really alienate or make people feel ashamed. It definitely holds Amazon to task, but it's also a positive story. And I think both books are really trying to show the power of bookstores as well as the dangers of it. And I think having a positive argument in your back pocket will help those discussions. Like, if, for example, you could talk about Amazon's labor practices, and I think you should talk about the privacy stuff, but imagine Hyde Park in Chicago without the Seminary Co-op. What would this neighborhood be? Where would Mia meet her husband if it's not for the booksellers? Having a really positive angle, too, really helps in those discussions. And I think your question about, like, well, I'm just one consumer, what am I going to do? This is a really important point as well, because you're right. If I withhold all my purchases from Amazon, statistically, Amazon is so big that it doesn't actually make a difference. They're not going to feel that pinch. I'm not really holding them to the fire or anything, because they have 170 million other customers. But if you look at that through a positive stance, who will feel my business is the Seminary Co-op. If I switch from buying a book a month on Amazon to a book a month at Seminary Co-op, that business is small enough and community-oriented enough that they absolutely will notice the difference of another regular person in their community. And so I don't think about it quite as much as withholding from Amazon as I do about contributing to these local community-oriented businesses. And that's why the book is called How to Resist and not How to Boycott. Because I think part of the resistance is putting your positive involvement and your money into places that are actively fighting to create the world that Amazon is trying to destroy. Nothing's really going to happen until corporate and policy changes take place. It's really frustrating to think about enacting policy on a national level. Like, you think about France and the Lang Law, which is passed in 1981. Like, that's the reason why Paris and France have so many bookstores. It's because there's a piece of policy that's been in place for decades that makes it make economic sense for bookstores to exist. Getting the Lang Law passed in the United States feels impossible, and it might actually be. But I don't want people to get discouraged about federal policy. I think it is absolutely crucial to be in communication with your representatives at a federal level about what's important to you, and not just about bookstores, but about everything else. But a lot of this stuff is local, and it's much easier to move the needle locally than it is federally. And it happens all the time. Amazon will come to a city and be like, we want to build a warehouse here. And the city will be like, great, here's a piece of land that you don't have to pay property taxes on for 30 years. A, what does it mean that a company like Amazon is getting that kind of benefits from the government? And B, why can't the person who wants to start a bookstore get a 30-year tax break too? What is it about Amazon? You know, yes, it's scale, but those are not sustainable jobs. They're dangerous jobs. It's not a great way to build a robust community. And if you're at city council saying this stuff into the microphone, it might actually move the needle. I mean, even right down to like, hey, where do you get your office supplies for City Hall? You get them from Amazon? What about the people here who are selling office supplies? Don't you want the economic activity to stay here? In the States, there's a really big thing with these right-wing hostile takeovers of school and library boards. These groups like Moms for Liberty have this template of how to take over a school board or a library board and get books banned, try to defund public education. And so if it feels impossible to get the Lang Law passed at the federal level, look at what's going on in your community, because local politics is just as important in this fight. Red Emma's in Baltimore, which is a fully employee-owned co-op that's been doing it for many, many years. It's an amazing radical bookstore and a delicious coffee shop. They just bought two adjacent buildings in the Waverly neighborhood of Baltimore to really create that kind of lasting permanence that I talked about when I read from the intro. Like, this is an activist space whose activists own the building. That's fully controlled by these great change makers in Baltimore, and they're using it to make Baltimore a better place. And not only that, they've got resources to help other businesses convert to employee-owned co-ops. And that part of their mission is to help spread the gospel of the employee-owned co-op. And they've successfully brought a couple other businesses on board in their neighborhood. I find their work just tremendously inspiring. So that's Red Emma's in Baltimore. I talked to a new Black-owned bookstore and a legacy Black-owned bookstore. The legacy bookstore Source Booksellers in Detroit. It's the oldest Black-owned bookstore in the Midwest of the United States, owned by a mother and daughter, Janet and Allison Webster Jones. They've been there since 1989 in some form. And that bookstore started as a vendor at festivals. Like, Janet would bring books and sell them from a table. And so she was literally in the community. And as that store has grown from the table to a temporary space to its permanent brick and mortar space, it's very literally an outgrowth of the community, because she started in the community and she still lets that philosophy really govern her, even as Detroit gentrifies and changes around her. They're very dedicated and plugged into their community in a really inspiring way. And it's, you know, 30 plus years. So again, really, really inspiring. I could go on all day, but those are two really cool examples from the book. Like, the more you go, the more you hang out, the more you browse, the more you go to events, you'll get to know the people who work there. They're small staffs. At the Raven, we have a couple people, a couple customers who will just like buy this one bookseller's staff pick. No matter what it is, if it's Nancy's staff pick, they'll buy it sight unseen, just because they like what Nancy reads generally. So I don't think it's terribly hard to befriend and get to know bookstore staff. The thing that unites my poetry and the nonfiction writing is my main obsession as a writer. Like, how do you live meaningfully in late capitalism? As corporations and global capitalist forces take over the world, what does it mean to try to have a meaningful human life? And I think the proliferation of objects might reflect that. A lot of what we do in this world is just a collection of objects. And regardless of whether it's good or bad, you build a nest. And it sounds like a lot of the poems you were referencing were from Picture Window, like the tennis ball. There are a ton of billboards in that book. And I think that book in particular, I wanted to write about the domestic in a way that I hadn't written about it so far. And then the pandemic happened. And so I kind of had to write about the domestic. I was forced into this weird, uneasy, claustrophobic domesticity. And when your attention is so focused within your own home and within your own family, every object in your house takes on a new resonance. And so a tennis ball that you've never seen somehow shows up in your house. Like, that's weird. That's interesting. It's poetic. It feels dreamlike. And that's kind of the vibe I was going for with that book. In terms of food, you also mentioned bacon. I think food is a really great shortcut into politics and identity and other things. Like, food as a metaphor or an objective correlative stand-in for bigger things. It's always been a really fun entry point for me to write through food towards bigger things. And I think that happens throughout all my poetry. I think the first time this happened was a poem I wrote really early on for my first book. And the first book is called Continental Breakfast. It ends with a sequence called Uncle Harold's Maxwell House Haggadah, which is about the corporate takeover of both Passover, the Jewish holiday, and just like life. And so I was at a grocery store on Cleveland's East Side, where a lot of the Jewish folks live, and just looking at the vast display of junk food that's kosher for Passover. And I was thinking about the kind of construction from the Haggadah. This is the bread of affliction. And I started listing all the junk food. It's like, this is the Manischewitz milk chocolate lolly cones of affliction. This is the kosher Coke of affliction. And thinking about ritual in contemporary America, where you're not giving up junk food, you're just eating a different kind of more expensive and less tasty junk food for the duration of this holiday. And it was interesting and funny to me. And I think the presence of this junk food ties into the story of Passover. And the Maxwell House Haggadah is by many means the defining ritual text for Passover in the United States. And it's like a corporate free premium. Since the 1920s, it's been like, you buy enough Maxwell House coffee, you get the free Haggadah. Like, this holiday has been intertwined with this giant coffee corporation. And it's interesting and complicated. Like, what are these things? Where are these sites where politics and identity and food meet? My third book, Flavortown, it's about the kind of vision that the Food Network feeds back to us of what authenticity should be. And what are we selling ourselves about what it means to eat via TV and a character like Guy Fieri? And how does that reflect the actual reality of what I eat every day? Every culture's food is really a reflection of who they are and what they say. And there's a lot to be said, especially in the Midwest, in America, about our food ways and who we are and who we think we are. The Jewish American Dream is really an attempt to invent a new kind of Jewish storytelling that's joyful and not 100% dependent on the traumas of the past. Because I think we're in a moment right now where we're seeing a lot of Jewish trauma be weaponized for political means, or very literally weaponized for violence. And I was interested in claiming a Jewish identity that's apart from that weaponization and politicization. Again, what does it mean to live meaningfully as a Jewish person in a world where Jewish identity is being weaponized for really violent means? And it is difficult. That didn't stop me from trying it. It felt really necessary. A lot of the people I'm in community in the Jewish world with are feeling really alienated from, you know, call it the mainstream Jewish response or mainstream Jewish messaging right now, and are looking for alternative modes of Jewish storytelling. And so I was like, well, I'm a poet. Every revolution needs a poet or multiple poets. So I'll give this a shot.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or to learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.